Good girl, Ruby. Come here. Come here. Good girl. Good girl. You can chase the ball. Good girl. Hi there. Thanks for tuning in. Just thought I'd let you know this is the last in the present series of Stand Up to Love the Darts. I'm just out walking the dog at the moment, getting some much-needed exercise. Dog's getting some good exercise as well, throwing the ball. I'm throwing the ball. She's running. If you've enjoyed the show, please let me know. At Dave Clark TV, my Twitter account. You can leave a message on my Anchor app as well. Be great to hear from you. Hopefully we'll do another series. If there's people you'd like to hear from particularly, just let me know. Drop me a line. And there's a few ideas I've got for guests as well. So enjoy the show. Quite an emotional one, this one, with Rod Studd, who had a health scare a while ago. More than a scare, a stroke. And he's well on the road to recovery, so you'll hear how he's doing now. So enjoy the show. Thanks for tuning in. And hopefully we'll bring you some more episodes in the future. Bye. Hi there, I'm Dave Clark. This is Stand Up If You Love the Darts, the podcast for darts lovers by a darts lover. Today's guest has been in the Sky Sports commentary box for many years and has witnessed some of the greatest moments in the sport's history, including this.
Game, shot, and Fallon Sherrick smashes the glass ceiling and wins at the World Darts Championship. The first woman to beat a man at the World Darts Championship. Fallon Sherrick is that woman on the 17th of December 2019. She defeats Ted Evans.
On the evening of May the 19th, 2020, his life changed forever when he collapsed, suffering a massive stroke. If it wasn't for the quick thinking of his wife Louise, he could have lost his life. The great news is he's very much alive and kicking and looking forward to return to the Sky Sports commentary box in the near future. Before we chat to Rod Studd, a huge thank you to the team at Target Darts for making this podcast possible. Game-changing quality darts products that really are a step beyond the rest. Check out their range online. No messing about. Let's get on with the show. Are you ready for darts? Rod Studd, welcome to Stand Up If You Love the Darts.
Thanks, Dave. Good to be here.
You're looking in fine fettle. I've got a Zoom link up here. And considering what you've been through, you look remarkably well, Rod.
Very kind of you, Dave. Very kind of you. The TV picture can disguise all sorts of ills, can't it, as we know?
It was May the 19th when your life could have changed forever. Just talk us through what happened then.
Yeah, I mean, it was back in the what we now call the first lockdown. It's a bit like, you know, having a First World War and a Second World War, isn't it? We had the first great lockdown and now the second great lockdown and et cetera and so forth. But yeah, it was the first great lockdown and, you know, obviously things weren't ideal. But one of the highlights we found as a family was like going for a family walk, which we did every evening around about tea time. You know, as you know, I live in your favourite county, Dave, in Yorkshire, and there's some beautiful scenery and beautiful places to go out and about for a walk, and that's what we used to do. And on this occasion, we'd been out walking, and we came back, and Mrs. Studd decided it was time for me to do hang the washing out. So off I trotted into the back garden to hang the washing out, and in the process of doing that, I started to feel a bit sort of iffy, a bit woozy, a bit funny. It was a bit like, you know, feeling that I was walking in quicksand. I realised I couldn't lift my feet up, on my left foot in particular. And then I thought, I'm going to collapse in a minute, which I did. And luckily, Louise was in the kitchen, which backs onto the garden. So she kind of heard what happened and came out and rescued me and got the ambulance. So, you know, without Louise and without the ambulance getting here so quickly, I mean, it may well have been a different story. So I was very lucky, really.
You spent a lot of time in hospital, didn't you? 32 days in hospital?
Yeah, it was around about 5 weeks, yeah, Dave. So that took me into in June last year. So it was at the back end of June 2020 that I got my pass out of hospital and came home and then started the rehab. So, yeah, it's been just over a year all told.
If people are worried about strokes and worried, you know, the symptoms, there's a thing called FAST, isn't there? Face dropping, arms, if you can't raise your arms, speech slurred.
That's right.
If yes, don't waste time and dial 999. That's the key message, isn't it?
That's right. It's a very important message that the Stroke Association puts out, you know, from time to time quite regularly. And it is very important because, as you've just suggested, identifying what's going on quickly is key. And I was lucky that Louise could remember one of their old adverts with that FAST message that you just outlined, FAST, and rang the ambulance because you know, any delay is, you know, can be very dangerous because it's called like a golden hour. If you can get to the hospital and get into a stroke ward within an hour, then your chances are much better.
Has it changed you as a person, do you think?
Difficult to say, you know, when you're looking at you, you know, it's sometimes easier to assess what's happening as a third party, and it's quite difficult and quite a good skill if you can step outside yourself and look at yourself as a third party. I think possibly I'm trying to be more relaxed and not get so het up about things, and you know, maybe have a more relaxed attitude to life and problems. I mean, you know, I used to get very, you know, aerated on Twitter with people, and you know, and I've tried to sort of get away from that quite a lot because in the end it doesn't really do any good ranting and raving at people. So I've tried to be a bit more relaxed about things. I'm not sure how well I've succeeded yet, Dave.
Because stress is a big problem, isn't it? Stress can cause strokes.
Stress is a problem. Yeah, I mean, my stroke was due to high blood pressure, but you know, I'm sure stress was related to that. So you know, stress isn't a great thing, and you know, the more relaxed you can be, the better.
Do you have any sort of stroke heroes that you look to? Because I have Parkinson's heroes, you know, like Michael J. Fox, and there's a guy called Alex Flynn who's an ultra runner. Who
people often talk about, you know, Andrew Marr, the political broadcaster, and Michael Johnson, the runner, who've both been very successful in resuming their career, and you know, I'd love to be able to follow in their footsteps. Difficult. I mean, the biggest hero I had was a guy called João on the ward, who was a complete lunatic. He was a Portuguese guy, but he was very, very funny. And, you know, his whole demeanour and attitude was really encouraging. He was just funny. I mean, the first thing I heard him say when I was on the bed next to him, someone came around and said, João, what can we get you to drink? And he said, I'd like a great milkshake, but in fact, forget the milk, just bring me a bottle of wine. And he'd pipe out from now and again. They'd come around with what you wanted for tea, and he'd say, look, every night I order lobster and champagne, and every night it fails to appear. Any more of this and I'll be moving to another hotel. And he used to refer to the place, but we were in the Calderdale Hospital in Halifax, and he used to just call it the Hotel Halifax. He'd bring his wife saying, I'm still in the Hotel Halifax. You know, but he really made a big difference to me, you know.
Humour's a big part of it, isn't it? If you can have a positive outlook on life.
Yeah, you've got to, you know, try and see some kind of funny side and some kind of light in amongst the shade, because otherwise it can get very dark, and you know, you don't want that. So yeah, very much, you know, it's very important to keep yourself upbeat. Over the period, I've begun to understand what you meant when you said, look, put something in your diary to look forward to. And, you know, it's a good watchword, isn't it?
Big time. Yeah, I also say don't mourn what you can't do. Celebrate what you can, you know. Yeah. Don't think about the fact you can't. I have days when I can't move my arms and stuff. My legs don't work properly.
Yeah.
And I think I'm still talking. I can still ring my friends, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think about the negative. I try and focus on the positive. You better have down days. You better have rubbish days. You better have days when you're feeling sorry for yourself. But hopefully they'll be few and far between.
Yeah, it's important, yeah. Cans, not can'ts, yeah, it's quite right. And I've thrown myself into the rehab, and, you know, I'm seeing progress, and, you know, I'm feeling better. You know, I feel, within myself, I feel pretty good, you know. I don't, you know, sometimes you're right, you do have down days, but generally I feel pretty good about things. I'm positive, so, you know, I'm ready to crack on with things.
But have you set yourself a goal of when you want to get back in the commentary box, or not? Is that not a good idea?
No, well... Yes and no, because I've got a lot of mates that work in Sky Rugby League as well, you know, people like Phil Clark and Brian Carney who've had, well, in Phil's case, you know, a career-ending injury when he broke his neck, and Brian Carney, lots of bad injuries, broken legs, you know, ruptured ACLs and stuff, and they were very good in giving me advice of not setting dates and targets, because it's not a good idea. Just say to yourself, I will be back doing it, but not, I don't know when, but... Now we've got close to the when, so at the moment my plan is to go back and do a couple of days at the match play at the back end of July.
That'd be great.
So,
be really good.
So now that's in my diary to look forward to, Dave.
Fantastic. Something in the diary to look forward to. Brilliant.
Yes, Sally.
Enough about the stroke. Enough about the stroke. We'll leave that for now. But let me talk about the first time I met you, because I have a feeling it was Alan. I'm a big Leeds fan. I think it was Elland Road in 91-92 season when Leeds won the title, and you were commentating for Radio Air on Leeds.
That's right, Radio Air in Leeds, Halcyon Days, Dave, which we haven't seen the like of until last season when they got back in the Premier League. But no, it was great. I mean, I went to work for Radio Air in July 1989. Gosh, long time ago, isn't it?
Long time ago, yeah.
I was watching the football the other day and they were saying it was 25 years since Gazza scored that goal at Wembley against Scotland. And you think, it can't be. You're 96 and 25 years ago. And then you do a bit of rudimentary maths and, of course, it is. So, 1989, that was the season when Leeds were in the second division then, and they got promoted to the first division, as we then called it, in the pre-Premier League days. They had a season in the Premier League where they did well, and then the next season, which was 91-92, well, they did better than well, and, they won the league, and it was a brilliant time, wasn't it? I mean, it was fantastic. I was very lucky. I just landed in Leeds at exactly the right time. I couldn't have timed it better. And it was a great time to be in Leeds and working in Leeds.
It was amazing. Vinnie Jones was a big star there, wasn't he? He came from...
He was a massive star.
He had a show on Radio Air.
I was just going to say that.
Most famous man in Leeds at the time.
He became a hero overnight, Vinnie Jones. And you're right, he did have a show on Radio Air where he played some of his favourite tunes. Yeah. Well, they were a good day. They had Strachan and Gary McAllister and Lee Chapman and Gary Speed, David Batty, they were a really good team, and it was a great year, great season.
That midfield was one of the best in football, wasn't it? With Strachan and Speed and McAllister and Batty.
I used to love David Batty because he was so smart, because he knew that he wasn't the most talented footballer in the team, but he was the best at getting the ball back off the opposition. So he got the ball and gave it to someone better than him, like Gary McAllister or Gordon Strachan. It was really exciting, and to beat like the arch rival Manchester United to the title, was just it was fairy tale stuff for Leeds supporters, and they had a long time to wait for something else to get excited about, didn't they? Because it went downhill relatively quickly after that.
Yeah, the money went and spent too much money, and it all went wrong.
Yeah, I'd long since gone since then, Dave. I disappeared. I got out while the game was good before it all went wrong. When the money disappeared and they went relegated.
And what happened to you after Radio Air?
Well, anyway, to cut a long story short, I ended up getting fired by Radio Air, and got fired by Radio Air in 1998, just coming up to the World Cup of 1998. I mean, and that was the best decision somebody else ever made for me. it got me out there just in time for the World Cup, where I kind of went on a kind of month-long bender, unfortunately not in France, round North Leeds, watching every single match of the World Cup. I think I missed half of one game, but I was there watching every game in local hostelries everywhere, sort of punting and drinking my way through the 98 World Cup. As I say, unfortunately not actually in France. But that was a great time. And anyway, then I sort of woke after Brazil, who I'd backed, lost the final to France. It kind of sobered me up, and I thought, "Oh God, I better go and get a job, because soon I'll be skint." So again, I was quite lucky, because as you know, Sky Sports News was just starting up, wasn't it? Just about to start, and they were just doing all the warm up and getting things ready, weren't they? And I'd done some stuff before for Sky, because one of the guys I knew, I worked with at Radio Air, Tim White, you'll remember Tim, and one of his big friends was Peter Hutton.
Yeah.
Who's now big cheese at Eurosport, isn't he?
I think he's gone bigger than that. I think he's AOL or something like that.
Amazon, yeah. But Peter was at Sky, and he knew the time of day, as you know, and he kind of got me and Tim to do some freelancing for Sky back in those days. And so I'd done some stuff, and I'd been to the studios, and I'd met Vic Wakely, the MD of Sky Sports, one of the great media gurus of the 20th century. Anyway, so I thought, well, I'll chance me. I'm all right to Vic. And he wrote back and said, you're in luck. We're just starting up this news channel. Write to, I think it was either Nick Seymour or Keith James. Write to them and tell them I sent you. And anyway, so I got down there and started doing some stuff for them. And it was about the same time as Pikey was also doing similar over in the Northwest. And, you know, I knew Pikey a bit from Piccadilly Radio in Manchester. So we started off doing all this stuff. And that was a great time. I was lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. And, you know, Sky Sports News launched, you know, and we got on board. And it was great. You know, we had a great sort of fun, well, umpteen years, really, until... I'll jump the gun here because you're going to ask how I got into this art. But I'll jump the gun. And it's a question you know the answer to full well, Dave. Because I was, you know, so we're having a great time at Sky Sports News until one day I was sat on the sofa at my parents' house. I think I might have actually been watching darts. And the phone went and it was some bloke called Dave Clark, who, of course, I knew from Capital Radio. And, of course, by this time was fronting the darts. And this Dave Clark sort of like said, listen, the darts is coming up in Bolton. I said, oh, yeah, the UK Open. And he said, well, we need someone to come and do some interviews and some reporting and stuff. Would you be interested? So after about a nanosecond, I went, yes. And you said, right, okay, well, I'll sort it all out with Rory, who runs the show, and we'll go from there. And I put the phone down and went, yes, this is brilliant, you know. So, and then sort of nothing happened, and then I thought I better ring this Rory character up, and you know. So I messaged him, I think emailed him, and I said, you know, what's happening? This was like the day before, and like, you know what Rory's like. I got an email about it that said 2:00 Reebok Stadium Thursday, be there. Welcome to the Arras, and that was it, you know. But and then I was in, so. And that was great. And at the Reebok, and so you remember it well, don't you? I mean, there was a big stage at the front where the main match would be on. Then there was a second stage; it was a little bit smaller when they'd put the second match. And then all the other matches would go on simultaneously. There was another 6 boards that just knocked up on a wall around the Reebok. So my job was to go running around finding the scores and reporting back. So say Sin and Pike were in the commentary, they'd say, right, let's see what's happening on board one, and chuck down to me. But so I'd go running round and I'd sit and watch the odd game. But where Sky were clever and helpful was that on each board they had someone sat there who was writing down the pattern of scoring, you know. So say it was like Smith v Jones, they'd write 1-0 to Smith, 1-1, 2-1 to Jones, 2-2, 3-2 to Jones. So I'd get there and I'd go, well, what's happening? And whoever was there would say, right, it's 4-3 to Jones. It was 3-0 to Smith, and Jones has won the last 4 legs. And in that time, he's hit 5 180s and taken out 120 and 140. And I'd go, right, thanks very much. Sid would throw down and I'd go, well, a great game down here, Sid. And Jones has come back from 3-0 down to lead 4-3 with a barrage of, you know, 180s, and he's just taken out 120 and 140 in the last 2 legs. Brilliant stuff. Anyway, so Sid then said to Rory later, he goes, this is brilliant. I mean, I studied down and he's got all these facts and figures. How's he managing to pull these out of his head? Well, he must be running around like a maniac. Rory goes, no, he's got someone sat there telling him, Sid.
The magic of television, that is.
Spoiled the illusion. But then, so then I'll be sat watching a game and, you know, you'd be about, I don't know, say 2 yards behind the hockey, you know, maybe about 5 yards from the board. But the light they had there was solely for the players so they could see where they were aiming. From where I was sitting, you couldn't see where the darts had gone. So my biggest fear would be that they'd say, well, tell us what's happening now. And of course, lo and behold, Rory told Sid, tell him to commentate. Right, and he'd be going down my ears, right, just commentate, tell us what's happening. And I thought, well, I'll have to say something. So I just, you know, bust along by, you know, waffling around the statistics that I had been given. And then if I knew what they want, so what they score they were on, because I could see they needed 40. So I knew they needed double top. So I was able to say, well, he now wants double top for the leg. But I hadn't got a clue where the dart had gone when he threw it, Dave. Hadn't got a clue. So I had to gauge that on his reaction. So if it went in, I'd know because he'd go, yes. So I said, he's got it, you know. But if he missed, I didn't know if it was over the top of double 20 or below it. So the only reason I could tell what happened then was if it had gone above it, he'd carry on aiming at it. But if it had gone below it, he'd now look down and go for double 10. So I'd have to sort of like second guess all the time what they'd hit and what they were aiming for. But I mean, it was great fun. And somehow I managed to get through. I got through it anyway. And then after that, Blackpool followed in July. And Rory rang me and said, do you want to do some commentary in Blackpool? So yeah, I did it. So then I was in and I went and did a commentary. I can't remember what the game was. It was Colin Lloyd or somebody. And it was with Sid. And then so I was in business. You know, and as a child of my generation, you know, having watched the darts from the 80s, you know, with Sid commentating, I was sat next to him. It was unbelievable.
Sid was an amazing guy, wasn't it? No, his like will never be seen again.
Absolutely incredible. And you know, not only such a brilliant commentator and wordsmith, but so learned and widespread in his knowledge, you know, from any subject you could talk about, Sid knew about it. You know, from his, you know, obviously his university education and his lifelong education in darts and being around the people in darts. I mean, just incredible knowledge, you know. Great to be around, both in the commentary environment and also, you know, having a drink of what he would describe as cooking lager after work. I still use that now.
Well, look back.
I still, you know, if I'm in the cricket club and they say, can I get you a drink? I always say, yeah, pint of cooking lager.
Well, he actually nicked that from me because there's a guy called Rory Williams who's a friend of mine. And he used to say, he's from Derby, this guy. He gives a pack of cooking lager, meaning a Foster's, a Heineken, low alcohol one.
Yeah,
and Sid nicked it. He loved it when he said it. I'm having that. And that was it. He used it forever. It was must be quite intimidating going in with one of your heroes, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. But you know, Sid was very, very quickly put me on my ease because... The one thing I do remember about almost every commentary I ever did with Sid, it would start in the same manner. Before we started, you know, we knew it was, you know, imminent, like a minute away. We'd sit in the box, commentary box, and he would always say, enjoy it, kid. Enjoy yourself. And that's a great mantra, isn't it?
Big time, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've always remembered.
You know, it can be a pressurised environment doing live sport, but if you enjoy it and relax, it gets the best out of you.
Yeah, it does, definitely, yeah. I mean, it's very important. I suppose it's a bit like the same as playing, isn't it? You know, if you're enjoying your work when you're playing, you're going to play better, I'd imagine. And for us, certainly, you know, that was a big thing. And, you know, Sid used to, you know, in the early days, sit you down and give you some advice and a little bit of feedback and help you, you know, maybe do it a bit different next time. It was good, but, you know, this might be a little bit better. How about if you did it like that, you know? And it was great because he knew what he was talking about, and it was, you know, it made you feel good that he was taking the time and trouble to spend time trying to make you get better.
Innovation, quality, passion. We invent and breathe freshness into the world of darts. Step beyond with Target Darts.
Yeah, massive thanks to the team at Target Darts for making this podcast possible. You're listening to Stand Up If You Love the Darts with me, Dave Clark. Why don't you subscribe and rate us? Sharing the love might just mean we can make a few more episodes. Back to the chat. Comes to the time of the show where we do a show and tell, Rod. Something from your career or something from life, an object that's not a person, not a member of the family. What you got for us?
Well, I mean, you would probably expect it to be darts related, but you'd be wrong. If it had been, it would have been a very close toss-up between my original Hawaii 501 Wayne Mardell shirt and a signed copy of something that he calls a book. But I didn't. So I went back to my childhood. You'll never get, you won't guess what that is, Dave. Let me try and lift it up to the camera.
It looks anyway. Like a This Is Your Life book.
Well, it is sort of This Is Your Life. I mean, that fine body of men is the Northwest Victoria 1983-84 squad. And This is like a file of stuff that I put together at the time with all the programmes of every match they played that season and all the newspaper cuttings. And a minuscule number of your audience might know that that was the season they won the FA Trophy. Having drawn at Wembley against Bangor City, they won the replay at the aptly named Victoria Ground Stoke, now no longer in existence, when they defeated Bangor with a last-minute goal from John Anderson. Epic night, Clarky. Epic night. I was 16 at the time. But it was, you know, so I kept all that and all the programs and everything. And it's probably worth literally pence now. but, I mean, it was quite... I look back now and it's quite instructive because a lot of sports fans, you know, you go through your time as a fan and you want the big night, don't you? I mean, obviously, you know, Leeds, they had the they won the league, so they had that day when they won the league. But there's always a big night or a big day or something great. And if it comes early, it's a bit of a struggle because you're always chasing that back again. You know, so if you were, I don't know, 10 when Leeds won the league, you know, you're constantly going through your life hoping to see it again. And maybe that was it, and it'll never happen again. So it's quite hard. And then that was like that, really. I was 16, so they won the Northern Premier, or the Conference North, about 2005-06. So there was another big day when they won something, but nothing compares. So if you do get the big thing early, you've got to enjoy it. That's the motto, the moral of the story. Got to enjoy it if you get it early.
Exactly. You've always been a bit of a sports anorak, haven't you? You've loved sport, yeah, with a passion all your life. I remember you used to hang around darts before you were involved in darts.
Yeah, I used to hang around darts all the time, yeah. I used to go quite often with Pikey before Pikey started working on the darts, and he started before me, but we used to go Blackpool. I used to go to Circus Tavern back in the early 2000s. I used to go there with Dave Allen, who's now the PDC's media guru. We used to go down there, you know, and have some rather debauched nights at the Circus Tavern. In fact, one year, which year would it have been? No, I'll tell you what it was. It was when Kevin Painter got beat in the final by Taylor. So at the Circus Tavern, they used to have a board with the draw on where, you know, they had a magnetic nameplate for each player. More than one, obviously, because they needed about 7 Phil Taylors as he progressed down the draw. And they used to just put the score right and put the magnetic tag through if they were through. Anyway, that was in the foyer at the Circus Tavern. So me and Dave Allen watched his final, which obviously went on long into the night when Taylor beat Painter. And then we realised we weren't going to get a taxi back, so we'd have to walk back to our hotel. And it was about, I don't know, it was probably about a mile or so. And I can't remember whose idea it was, but one of us decided that we'd take the draw board as a souvenir. So there we were, you know, walking down the main road in Purfleet, or, you know, two of us holding this draw board like hod carriers walking. And then we woke up the next morning. I woke up in my hotel room and I thought, what the heck is that there? Then I realised what had happened. And then we had to think how we were going to get it home. But I mean, it's quite ridiculous. But, you know, I used to go there. I used to go all the darts tournaments before I started working. But, you know, yeah, big, big fan before I started being part of it, for sure, yeah.
Circus Tavern was one of the great venues, wasn't it? Really, really small and almost claustrophobic.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the great sporting venues. And when they used to these enormous arenas, like, you know, the one in Dublin or Leeds Arena, and they say, well, what's the fuss about with the Circus Tavern? And you end up going a bit sort of like old fogies with, oh, you had to be there and, oh, lad in our day, you know. And you'll get all misty-eyed talking about the great deeds of the Circus Tavern and the great final between Taylor and Van Barneveld. Or Barneveld, as he was there, wasn't he? He was just Barneveld.
Yeah.
He hadn't got the van then. you know, great days down there, you know, the great time when Adrian Lewis walked off against Peter Wundart Manley, you know, and all the epic darting gladiators that battled there, you know, so it was great, you know.
I remember once Barry Hearn trying to make it a bit classier And what he did, he invited Marco Pierre White, the chef.
Yeah, I remember, the pies.
To do pheasant pies for everybody. And when I was a kid, I used to wash up occasionally in a restaurant. And I washed up a couple of times to Marco Pierre White. He worked at a restaurant called the Box Tree.
He was in Leeds, wasn't he?
He worked in Ilkley for a while, in the Box Tree.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I washed up for him a couple of times. And I said to him, you won't remember me, but I used to wash up for you when I was a kid. He said, you're right, I don't. Walked off. And I thought, oh, it's great, thanks very much. I was looking forward to having a chat with you. And he made these pheasant pies for everybody to make it a bit classier. So you drink your Skol Lager, have a pheasant pie. But pheasant pies ended up in a food fight at the back. So I was, bit of me was quite pleased. He'd snubbed me and his pheasant pies ended up in on the floor, trampled into the carpet.
Yeah, with all sorts of other things, Yeah, I remember going back there in the daylight once to do an interview for Sky Sports News after Taylor had won. And the light that was shining through from the door, and you could see what the actual state of the decor was. And it was a bit like, oh, were we really in here last night? Oh, God, what's happening here? But that all, in the end, that became part of the charm, didn't it?
Big time, yeah, yeah. The move to Alexandra Palace was a big one. And that sort of, it's established itself as a terrific venue now, hasn't it?
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. I mean, you know, I still get a big thrill walking into the Alexandra Palace. Now, you know, you walk in, even when, say, the day is starting and you know that darts is coming, and you go in and you can just look around the stands, you know, and the enormous stage. You know, and that's the big difference, isn't it? The stage at the Alexandra Palace. I think, you know, Mardell tried one of his crazy walk-ons there once and realised halfway through it he was exhausted because he'd gone across the whole stage. And I know... I'm sure Peter Wright feels the same, doesn't he, when he does his dance all the way along the stage. About halfway through, he must say, oh, God, another 20 yards of this yet, you know. And that's the difference between that and the circus, because the Alexandra Palace is an enormous arena, and the circus tab and the stage was virtually in the crowd, wasn't it? I mean, Wayne often says that, you know, he could lean out and touch people and shake hands with his fans from the stage, you know. So it's an enormous difference, and... You know, it's become the home of darts now, hasn't it? You know, it's adopted that role.
I was looking through YouTube, a few of the clips of your commentary. One that really stands out is this one.
Game, shot! And Fallon Sherrod smashes the glass ceiling and wins at the World Darts Championship. The first woman to beat a man at the World Darts Championship. Fallon Sherrod is that woman on the 17th of December 2019. She defeats Ted Evans.
That was an amazing night, wasn't it? And that bit of commentary went global. It was on every news channel around the world.
That'd have been quite nice. You know, if it was like, you know, like if you've written a song, you're like Noddy Holder always says that Merry Christmas Everybody's his pension because he wrote it and he gets that small amount of pence every time someone plays it every Christmas. Yeah, but no, it was a brilliant night. It really was epic. I mean, it's a bit like one of those things that you knew it was coming, not specifically in that match, but, you know, you felt that women were getting very close to winning a game of that tournament. And we'd seen, you know, Makura Suzuki almost win in that same championship. Lisa Ashton had gone close before, so it wasn't a massive surprise, but it was still, a massive leap forward for darts.
Another bit of great commentary was 2015, Gary Anderson beating Taylor. That was a magnificent match. I'll just play that.
And it's glory, glory, Gary Anderson at the Alexandra Palace. He follows in the darting footsteps of the legendary jockey Wilson and wins the World Championship for Scotland.
I've got goosebumps listening to that.
Yeah, that was a brilliant match. That, I mean, that was an epic. I mean, I don't know how long it went on for, but it was probably a couple of hours, you know. But it was a brilliant match, you know, and he could have gone the other way. It was very close, but, you know, epic night for Anderson.
I've got another clip here, which is great, which is Van Gerwen against Anderson in the Premier League in Newcastle. It was an amazing game, and Van Gerwen nearly got a 9-darter. Anderson took out a 170. Quite incredible.
9-darters in the Premier League all started by Barney back in the day. The big fish. This is madness. It's absolute madness. 20 seconds ago, we were talking about a possible 9-dart leg for Michael Van Gerwen, and now the leg is in the ledger under the name of Gary Anderson.
That's one of the greatest legs I've seen. You miss a nine-darter. You miss a nine-darter. And you get punished. Punished to the hill. Oh, my word. Oh, my word. What a 170.
It was an amazing match, that. I remember it well. Just dart for dart match each other for ages.
Yeah, it was amazing. But, you know, you talk about, you know, you've got to have your eye on the ball. And I tell you what, I nearly got caught out there because I hadn't even noticed. I was too busy focusing on Van Gerwen being on 141 for the nine darter. I hadn't noticed. Well, I hadn't even got a clue what Anderson was on. And then suddenly I thought, hang on a minute. He's hit two treble 20s and his eye line is now looking at the bullseye. What's going on? And I looked at the score and it's like 170, and that's when I woke up. I was in a nine dart trance there for a minute. But luckily I woke up just a split second before he hit the bullseye, so I got away with it.
Tell me about your relationship with Wayne, because that's wonderful. Well, symmetry you've got with him.
Can't stand him. Can't stand the bloke, honestly. People say, who do you prefer commentating with? And I say, ABM, anyone but Martin. No, seriously. But seriously, you know, I'll let your listeners into a secret. It's just a faux animosity for the broadcast. You know, it's a bit like my favourite broadcasting combination is largely, certainly in football and generally, is John Champion and Alistair McCoist, because they play that kind of faux animosity brilliantly. I think it's hilarious. So we kind of like... Well, it's kind of a bit like that, and I hope we managed to carry it off quite well. But the reality is, he's actually probably my best friend on the team, and you know, we spend all our time together. As you know, we're always knocking about somewhere together, usually in a betting shop. But he's a great friend.
It must be weird having not been with him for a year, basically.
Well, yeah, I have seen him a couple of times when rules and regulations are permitted. We've been down to St. Osyth, as I call it, to annoy him. St. Osyth, where he lives. So we've been down a couple of times, and, you know, the kids have been in this dart school, so that was quite exciting. But, yeah, so hopefully all will be back in business, you know, pretty shortly, Dave, and we can resume. You know, but, you know, it's been great fun, you know. I tease him a lot about stuff, and obviously the Kirk Shepherd thing is one of them. But at the time, I just thought, "Oh, what an idiot! How has he managed to do that?" But now I think, "Oh, I wish he'd won."
Yeah, it was amazing when he beat Taylor. I said to him, "I think, how's it sound to be Wayne Mildon World Champions?"
Yeah.
don't go on about it. Don't go on about it. Don't jinx it. And I felt guilty about that now, because I genuinely thought that year he was going to win it.
It was a big chance, wasn't it? Massive chance, and as it turned out, it was the last chance. It's a shame, but you know, if he had won, you know, you talk about things changing your life, you know, it would have changed his life, and would he have been the same Wayne Mardell? And he's not here to correct me here, I'm saying Mardell, because I mean, that's obviously one of the running gags, is that I constantly call him Mardell, and he interrupts with Mardell, and I just carry on as if nothing has happened. But, you know, I mean, that actually started when Phil Taylor, in interviews with you, Dave, used to refer to him as Wayne Mardell, doesn't he? He'd say, well, it's all right, Wayne Mardell saying such and such, you know. And anyway, so then I called him Mardell. He goes, it's Mardell. And I said, hang on a minute. Phil Taylor says Mardell. Are you saying that the 16 times world darts champion doesn't know what he's talking about? If Phil Taylor says it's Mardell, the end.
They can be quite tricky, some of those interviews sometimes, can't they? You've run into a few times. Taylor, you've had a few little skirmishes with, verbal sparring with.
Yeah, I mean, the Taylor one is quite a famous one. That was in Dublin. He got the ump about what I thought was a fairly innocuous question. He'd beaten James Wade, and Wade had somehow got under his skin a bit in that match. And I thought early on in the interview, something's, you know, nibbling at him here. He's not happy about something. And really, I should have, you know, thought, just steer clear of controversy. But I couldn't help myself, because he was playing Dave Chisnell in the final. And that was a little while, but it was the next televised meeting with Chisnell following the Chisnell beating him at the World Championship. Although, you know, 9 or 10 months had elapsed. So anyway, I said, so you're playing Dave Chisnell in the final, and of course people will remember him beating you at the World Championship. Well, that was it. for some reason, that was the question. In fact, looking back at it now, I think if I'd said, what's your favourite cheese, he'd have gone off and felt insulted by it. But he was insulted by that, and he said, well, what sort of question is that? And I said, well, I've got to remind you. And he goes, well, why have you? He goes, I've just won a match. Why are you talking about me losing one? I said, well, it's a match people remember, and you're playing him again next. He goes, well, I've beaten him since then anyway. I said, well, all right. He said, why don't you talk about the fact I'm the world champion. I've won the world championship 16 times. And I went, all right then. All right then, Phil. You've won the world championship 16 times. What about the Chisnell game? Because at that point, I thought, right, you're having it now. But he was absolutely furious. In my mind, he had no right to be. But, you know, he ended up having to be sort of like taken away by the security guards around by the stage.
It's quite weird because Phil would be nice as pie to you when he saw you away from the match situation. Yeah. And then towards the end, he got a bit prickly. I don't know why it was. Yeah. I think he thought he knew he was going to retire. And yeah. and the players were backbiting a bit and jealous of what he'd achieved. And I think he just felt uncomfortable in the environment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Just as a footnote to that story, though, he did ring Matt Porter, the chief executive of the PDC, the day after, and said he wanted to apologise. And Matt said, Phil said, can you come to the practice room? And then I went there and he offered his hand and apologised. And that was it, you know. So that was the end of it. So he was man enough to apologise, and that drew the line under it, and we were fine after that. But as regards Taylor afterwards getting a bit prickly, I think that's right. I think one of the hardest things for a sportsman or sportswoman to do that's been the world number one or the best in the world by some distance is to accept that they're not the best anymore. And it's very hard, you know, to accept that the other players are now better than them and to deal with it. And I think, you know, if Phil Taylor looks back, he will think maybe he didn't deal with it all that well. I mean, you look at how Federer's dealt with it in tennis. You know, I'm sure he knows or knew a few years ago that Nadal and certainly Djokovic had overtaken him, but he still believed he could beat them on any given day and still went on to win tournaments. I mean, but to be fair to Phil Taylor, he did go on to win the match play again, didn't he, in that epic performance. You know, when he won his 16th match play, when he was written off as a no-hoper, the bookmakers had him at 25-1. And that was probably, actually, arguably, his greatest win of all. Because he beat all the best players in the world, you know, one after the other. You know, Van Gerwen and Barney, Gerwyn Price, who was just on the rise then. Adrian Lewis, who was right at the top then. So he beat all the best players back-to-back and won the match play for the 16th time. And then went to Alexandra Palace, got to the final and said, thanks very much, I'm off. So he went out, he did go out on a real high in the end.
Perfect symmetry as well. 16 world titles, 16 world match play titles. It doesn't get any better than that.
No, it was absolutely incredible. Absolutely epic. Fairy tale stuff, really. You know, it could only have been topped if he'd broken the symmetry by beating Rob Cross in that final. But Cross was just almost unplayable. And so I think for Phil Taylor, it was still a great way to go. And he missed a double 12 for a 9 darter in the final, even though he got on the wrong end of a heavy beating. It was still a good way to go out.
People say, why do you love the darts? It's things like that. It's ordinary men doing extraordinary things. The fact that they just get 180 after 180, get 9 darters. It's, everyone's played darts. Everyone knows how tough it is. And doing that under that sort of pressure, it blows my mind even now.
Well, that's the thing. You're quite right. Everyone's had a go, haven't they? It's a sport that everyone's had a go at. You know, maybe unlike other individual sports like golf, not everybody, you know, has gone out on a golf course and can afford to go and play and join a golf club. But darts, pretty much everyone's picked up 3 arrows and had a chuck in a pub. And they know, you know how difficult it is to hit a single 20, never mind a treble, never mind 3 trebles, and then followed by a double or the bullseye. You know, so I mean, the skill level is absolutely incredible. And, you know, it's a very addictive sport because a leg of darts, you know, where if Yellow Class is playing, it could be about 75 seconds. But even in players a little bit more pedestrian, it would only be about 2.5 minutes. So that leg finishes and that spin of the roulette wheel, a number has been declared, and now it'll spin again straight away. So it's very addictive, you know. You know, you find yourself sitting watching and going, I'll just watch one more leg. I'll just watch one more leg. I'll just watch one more leg. And, you know, when people say, well, what's the fascination with it? Really, if you say, I generally say, well, just sit down and watch it for a little while. And if you still don't like it, don't watch it. But almost invariably, they will watch it and get hooked like we all have. Invariably, that's a Mardell story. He once said it in the commentary box. Van Gerwen hit double 16, I said, and he goes, he invariably hits double 16. I said, no, he doesn't. He misses sometimes. And he just looked at me strangely. This was in commentary. And I said, well, what do you think invariably actually means? And he, I mean, it's one of the most misused words in the English language. So he starts fumbling around on his phone to dictionary.com or something. And he comes back and he goes, I've looked it up. He does hit it invariably, but just not every time.
If you had to just remember one moment that during your career that sums it up and how much fun it's been so far, what would it be? Is there one moment you'd like to just talk about?
Well, I'll bring in Mardelli because I saw someone tweet you about this and say, get stuck to talk about this. And this was, it was great fun. It was in the match play. And it was Peter Wright against Simon Whitlock. Peter Wright wanted 170. Simon Whitlock was on 200 or 300, not on a finish. Now, as we all know from experience, generally in that situation, a player on 170, even if they hit two treble 20s, would go for a 10 to leave 40 or 18 to leave double 16. But anyway, he wanted 170, and Mardell was straight in early with, I fancy him. I fancy him for the fish. That's the big fish that I once caught 170, which became a phrase. And I just went, do you? And he went, yes, I fancy him. I cannot see any other outcome. So he hits treble 20 and another treble 20. And Wayne goes, I cannot see any other outcome. Bang, bullseye. And I just went, that's it. Nothing on top of that tonight. I'm off. And just opened the commentary box door and shut it again like I'd left. But it was
that
was the fun of the game. That's the fun of it all.
It's been brilliant chatting to you, Rod. I wish you a speedy recovery. I hope you get back in the commentary box soon. Thanks for sharing the journey with me as well. It's been amazing the last 10 years where we worked together. And I really enjoyed our time. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure, Dave. Thanks for getting me the job in the first place.
Top man. That was Stand Up If You Love the Darts. A huge thank you to Rod Studd for sharing some top memories. Good to see him looking so well and hopefully see him back in the commentary box soon. Thanks too to the great team at Target Darts for supporting this podcast. Target make equipment for the host of top pros, including Phil Taylor, Barney and Adrian Lewis. World-beating engineering, world-beating equipment. Check out their range online. That's all we've got time for. We'll leave you with some Mardell mind reading.
Thanks, Ian, for it. I fancy him for the fish.
Do you?
Yes, I do. I can't see any other outcome. I cannot see any other outcome.
Gives on the fourth leg. Beezer on.
I'm chasing her on the way out. There's no point now. Nothing will top that.